Good morning, everybody. This is Mr. Malone. Today I'm going to be reading The Hitchhiker by Roald Dahl. I had a new car. It was an exciting toy. A big BMW 3.3 Li, which means 3.3 liter. Long wheelbase, fuel injection. It had a top speed of 129 miles per hour and terrific acceleration. The body was pale blue, the seats inside were a darker blue, and they were made of genuine leather. Soft and of the finest quality. The windows were electrically operated, and so was the sunroof. The radio aerial popped up when I switched on the radio and disappeared when I switched it off. The powerful engine growled and grunted impatiently at slow speeds, but at 60 miles per hour, the growling stopped and the motor began to purr with pleasure. I was driving up to London by myself. It was a lovely June day. They were haymaking in the fields, and there were buttercups along both sides of the road. I was whispering along at 70 miles per hour, leaning back comfortably in my seat, with no more than a couple of fingers resting on lightly on the wheel to keep her steady. Ahead of me, I saw a man thumbing a lift. I touched the brake and brought the car to a stop beside him. I always stop for hitchhikers. I knew just how it used to feel to be standing on the side of a country road, watching cars go by. I hated the drivers for pretending they didn't see me, especially the ones in big cars with three empty seats. The large expensive cars seldom stopped. It was always the smaller ones that offered you a lift, or the old rusty ones, or the ones that were already crammed full of children, and the driver would say, "I think we can squeeze in one more." The hitchhiker poked his head through the open window and said, "Going to London, Governor?" "Yes," I said. "Jump in." He got in, and I drove on. He was a small, ratty-faced man with grey teeth. His eyes were dark and quick and clever, like a rat's eyes, and his ears were slightly pointed at the top. He had a cloth cap on his head, and he was wearing a greyish-coloured jacket with enormous pockets. The grey jacket, together with the quick eyes and the pointy ears, made him look more than anything like some sort of large human rat. "What part of London are you heading for?" I asked him. "I'm going right through London and out the other side," he said. "I'm going to Epsom for the races. It's Derby Day today." "So it is," I said. "I wish I were going with you. I love betting on horses." "I never bet on horses," he said. "I don't even watch them run. That's stupid, silly business. "Then why do you go?" I asked. He didn't seem to like that question. His little ratty face went absolutely blank, and he sat there, staring straight ahead at the road, saying nothing. "I expect you work the betting machines or something like that," I said. "That's an even sillier," he said. "It's no fun working them lousy machines and selling tickets to mugs. Any fool can do that." There was a long silence. I decided not to question him anymore. I remember how irritated I used to get in my hitchhiking years when drivers kept asking me questions. "Where are you going? Why are you going there? What's your name? Are you married? Do you have a girlfriend? What's her name? How old are you?" So on and so forth. I used to hate it. "I'm sorry," I said. "It's none of my business what you do. The trouble is, I'm a writer, and most writers are terribly nosy." "You write books?" he asked. "Yes." "Writing books is okay," he said. "It's what I call a skilled trade." "I'm in a skilled trade too. The folks I despise are them that spend all their lives doing crummy old routine jobs with no skill in them at all. You see what I mean?" "Yes." "The secret of life," he said, "is to become very, very good at something. And that's very, very hard to do." "Like you," I said. "Exactly. You and me both." "What makes you think that I'm good at my job?" I asked. "There's an awful lot of bad writers around." "You wouldn't be driving around in a car like this if you were no good at it," he answered. "It must have cost you a tidy packet, this old job." "It wasn't cheap." What can she do flat out? He asked. 129 miles per hour, I told him. I bet she wouldn't do that. I bet she will. All car makers lie, he said. You can buy a car you like, and it'll never do what the maker says it'll do in the ads. This one will. Open her up and prove it then, he said. Go on, Governor. Open her right up, and let's see what she'll do. There's a traffic circle at Chalfont St. Peter, and immediately beyond is a long straight section of divided highway. We came out of the circle and onto the highway, and I pressed my foot down hard onto the accelerator. The big car leaped forward as though she'd been stung. In 10 seconds or so, we were doing 90. Lovely, he cried. Keep her going. I had the accelerator jammed right down against the floor and held it there. 100, he shouted. 105, 110, 115. Go on, don't slack off. I was on the outside lane, and we flashed past several cars as if they were standing still. A green Mini, a big green-colored Citroen, and a white Land Rover. A huge truck with a container on the back, and an orange-colored Volkswagen minibus. 120! My passenger shouted, jumping up and down. Go on! Go on! Get her up to 129! At that moment, I heard a scream of a police siren. It was so loud it seemed to be right inside the car. And then, a cop on a motorcycle loomed up alongside us on the inside lane and went past us and raised his hand for us to stop. Oh, my sainted aunt, I said. That's torn it. The cop must have been doing 130 when he passed us, and took plenty of time slowing down. Finally, he pulled to the side of the road, and I pulled behind him. I didn't know police motorcycles could go that fast, I said rather lamely. That one can, said my passenger. It's the same make as yours. It's a BMW R90S, fastest bike on the road. That's what they're using nowadays. The cop got off his motorcycle and leaned the machine sideways onto its prop stand. Then he took off his gloves and placed them carefully on the seat. He was in no hurry now. He had us where he wanted us, and he knew it. This is real trouble, I said. I don't like it one bit. Don't talk to him more than is necessary, you understand, my companion said. Just sit tight and keep mum. Like an executioner approaching his victim, the cop came strolling slowly towards us. He was a big, meaty man with a belly, and his blue breeches were skin tight around his enormous thighs. His goggles were pulled up onto his helmet, showing a smoldering red face with wide cheeks. We sat like guilty schoolboys, waiting for him to arrive. Watch out for this man, my passenger whispered. He looks an evil devil. The cop came round to my open window, and placed one meaty hand on the sill. What's the hurry? He said. No hurry, officer, I said. Perhaps there's a woman in the back having a baby and you rush into the hospital. Is that it? No, officer. Or perhaps your house is on fire, and you're dashing home to rescue your family from upstairs. His voice was dangerously soft and mocking. My house is not on fire, officer, I said. In that case, he said, what have you got? You've got yourself into a nasty mess, haven't you? Do you know what the speed limit is in this country? 70, I said. And do you mind telling me exactly what speed you were doing just now? I shrugged and didn't say. When he spoke next, he raised his voice so loud that I jumped. 120 miles per hour, he barked. That's 50 miles an hour over the speed limit. He turned on his head and spat out a big blob of spit. It landed on the wing of my car and started sliding down over my beautiful blue paint. Then he turned back again and stared hard at my passenger. And who are you? He said sharply. He is a hitchhiker, I said. I'm giving him a lift. I didn't ask you, he said. I asked him. Have I done something wrong? My passenger said. His voice was soft and oily as hair cream. That's more than likely, the cop answered. Anyways, you are a witness. I'll deal with you in a minute. Driver's license? He snapped out of my hand. He snapped, holding his hand out. I gave him my driver's license. He unbuttoned the left breast pocket of his tunic and brought out the dreaded book of tickets. Carefully, he copied the name and address down from my license. Then he gave it back to me. He strolled round to the front of the car and read out the number from the license plate and wrote that down as well. He filled in the date, the time, and the details of my offence, and then he tore out a copy of the ticket. But before handing it to me, he double-checked that all the information had come through on his own carbon copy. Finally, he replaced the book in his breast pocket and fastened the button. Now you, he said to my passenger. And he walked around to the other side of the car. From the breast pocket, he produced a small black notebook. Name, he snapped. Michael Fish, my passenger said. Address, 14 Windsor Lane, Luton. Show me something to prove your real name and address, the policeman said. My passenger fished into his pocket and came out with a driver's license of his own. The policeman checked the name and address and handed it back to him. What's your job? He asked sharply. I'm an odd carrier.
A what?
An odd carrier. Spell it. C-O-D-C-A. That'll do. What's a hod carrier, may I ask? An odd carrier is a person who carries cements up a ladder to a bricklayer. And the odd is what he carries it on. It's got a long handle at the top and bits of wood set at an angle. All right, all right. Who's your employer?
I don't have one. I'm unemployed.
The cop wrote all this down in his black notebook. He returned the book to his pocket and did up the button. When I get back to the station, I'm going to do a little checking up on you, he said to my passenger.
Me? What have I done wrong?
The rat-faced man said. I don't like your face, that's all, said the cop. We might just have a picture of it somewhere in our files. He strolled around the car and returned to my window. I suppose you know you're in serious trouble, he said to me.
Yes, officer.
You won't be driving this fancy car of yours for a very long time. Not after I've finished with you. You won't be driving any car, for several years. And good thing, too. I hope they lock you up for a spell into the bargain.
I mean, you mean prison? I asked, alarmed.
Absolutely, he said, smacking his lips. In the clink, behind bars, along with all the other criminals who break the law, and a hefty fine into the bargain. Nobody will be more pleased about that than me. I'll see you in court, both of you. You'll be getting a summons to appear. He turned away and walked over to his motorcycle. He flipped the prop stand back into position with his boot and swung his leg over the saddle. Then he kicked the starter and roared off up the road out of sight. Whew, I gasped. That's done it. We was caught, my passenger said. We was caught good and proper.
I was caught, you mean?
That's right, he said. What are you going to do now, Governor?
I'm going straight up to London to talk to my solicitor, I said. I started the car and drove on.
You mustn't believe what he said about you going to prison, my passenger said. They don't put nobody in the clink just for speeding.
Are you sure of that? I asked.
I'm positive, he answered. They can take away your license, they can give you a whopping big fine, but that'll be the end of it. I felt tremendously relieved. By the way, I said, why did you lie to him?
Who, me? He said.
What makes you think I lied? You told him you were an unemployed hod carrier.
But you told me you were a highly skilled trade.
So I am, he said. But it don't pay to tell everything to a copper.
So what do you do? I asked him.
Ah, he said sighly. That'd be telling, wouldn't it?
Is it something you're ashamed of?
Ashamed, he said. Me? Ashamed of my job? I'm about as proud as anybody could be in the entire world.
Then why won't you tell me?
You writers really is nosy parkers, aren't you? He said.
And you ain't going to be happy, I don't think, until you found out exactly what the answer is. I don't really care one way or another, I told him. Lying. He gave me a crafty little ratty look from the side of his eyes. I think you do care, he said. I can see it on your face. You think I'm in some kind of very particular trade, and you're just aching to know what it is. I didn't like the way he read my thoughts. I kept quiet and stared at the road ahead. You'd be right, too, he went on. I am in a very particular trade. I'm in the queerest particular trade of them all. I waited for him to go on. That's why I have to be so extra careful on who I'm talking to, you see. How I know, for instance, that you're not a copper, and how do I know, for instance, that you're not a copper in plain clothes? Do I look like a copper? No, he said, you don't. And you ain't. Any fool could tell you that. He took from his pocket a tin of tobacco and a packet of cigarette papers and started to roll a cigarette. I was watching him out of the corner of my eye, and the speed with which he performed this rather difficult operation was incredible. The cigarette was rolled and ready in about 5 seconds. He ran his tongue along the edge of the paper and stuck it down and popped the cigarette between his lips. Then, as if from nowhere, a lighter appeared in his hand. The lighter flamed, the cigarette was lit, and the lighter disappeared. It was altogether a remarkable performance. I've never seen anyone roll a cigarette as fast as that, I said. Ah, he said, taking a deep suck of the smoke. So you noticed? Of course I noticed. It was quite fantastic. He sat back and smiled. It pleased him very much that I had noticed how quickly he could roll a cigarette. You want to know what makes me able to do it? He said. Go on then. It's because I've got fantastic fingers. These fingers of mine, he said, holding up both of his hands in front of him, are quicker and cleverer than the fingers of the best piano player in the world. Are you a piano player? Don't be daft, he said. Do I look like a piano player? I glanced at his fingers. They were so beautifully shaped, so slim, so long and elegant. They didn't even seem to belong to the rest of him at all. They looked more like the fingers of a brain surgeon or of a watchmaker. My job, he went on, is 100 times more difficult than playing a piano. Any twerp can learn to do that. There's titchy little kids learning to play the piano almost anywhere. Any house you go into these days. Isn't that right? More or less, I said. Of course it's right. But there's not one person in 10 million that can learn to do what I do. Not one in 10 million. How about that? Amazing, I said. You're damn right it's amazing, he said. I think I know what you do. You do conjuring tricks. You're a conjurer. Me, he snorted, a conjurer. Can you picture me going around crummy kids' parties, making rabbits come out of hats? Then you're a card player. You get people into card games and you deal yourself marvelous hands. Me, a rotten card sharper, he cried. That's a terrible racket, if ever there was one. All right, I give up. I was taking the car along slowly now, no more than 50 miles an hour, to make quite sure I wasn't stopped again. We had come onto the main Oxford Road, London Oxford Road, and were running down the hill towards Denham. Suddenly, my pastor was holding up a black leather belt in his hand. Ever seen this before? He said. The belt had a brass buckle of unusual design. Hey, I said. That's mine, isn't it? It's mine! Where did you get it? He grinned and waved the belt gently from side to side. Where do you think I got it? He said. Off the top of your trousers, of course. I reached down and felt for my belt. It was gone. You mean you took it off me while I've been driving along? I asked, flabbergasted. He nodded, watching me all the time with those little black ratty eyes. That's impossible, I said. You've had to undo the buckle, slide the whole thing through the loops all the way around, and I'd have seen you doing it. Even if I hadn't seen you, I'd have felt it. But you didn't, did you? He said triumphantly. He dropped the belt on his lap And now, all at once, there was a brown shoelace dangling from his finger. "And what about this, then?" he exclaimed, waving the shoelace. "What about it?" I said. "Anywhere around here missing a shoelace?" he asked, grinning. I glanced down at my shoes. The lace of one of them was missing. "Good grief," I said. "How did you do that?" "I never saw you bending down." "You never saw nothing," he said proudly. "You never saw me move an inch. And you know why that is?" "Yes," I said, "because you've got fantastic fingers." "Exactly right," he said. "You catch on pretty quick, don't you?" He sat back and sucked away at his homemade cigarette, blowing the smoke out into the thin stream against the windshield. He knew he'd impressed me greatly with those two tricks, and this made him very happy. "I don't want to be late," he said. "What time is it?" "There's a clock in front of you," I told him. "I don't trust car clocks," he said. "What does your watch say?" I hitched up my sleeve and looked at my watch on my wrist. It wasn't there. I looked at the man, and he looked back at me, grinning. "You've taken that too," I said. He held out his hand, and there was my watch lying in his palm. "Nice bit of stuff, this," he said. "Superior quality, 18 karat gold, easy to sell too. It's never any trouble getting rid of good quality goods." "I'd like it back if you don't mind," I said rather huffily. He placed the watch on the leather tray in front of him. "I wouldn't nick anything from you, Governor," he said. "You're my pal. You've given me a lift." "I'm glad to hear it," I said. "All I'm doing is answering your question," he went on. "You ask me what I do for a living, and I'm showing you." "What else have you got off me? What else have you got off mine?" He smiled again. Now he started to take from the pockets of his jacket one thing after another that belonged to me. My driver's license, a key ring with four keys on it, some pound notes, a few coins, a letter from my publisher, my diary, a stubby old pencil, a cigarette lighter, and last of all, a beautiful old sapphire ring with pearls around it that belonged to my wife. I was taking the ring to the jeweler in London because one of the pearls was missing. "Now there's another lovely good piece of goods," he said, turning the ring over his finger. "That's 18th century, if I'm not mistaken. From the reign of King George III. "You're right," I said, impressed. "You are absolutely right." But he put the ring on the leather tray with the other items. "So you're a pickpocket," I said. "Ooh, I don't like that word," he answered. "It's coarse and vulgar word. Pickpockets is coarse and vulgar people who only do little easy amateur jobs. They lift money from blind old ladies." "What do you call yourself then?" "Me? I'm a fingersmith. I'm a professional fingersmith." He spoke the words solemnly and proudly, as though he were telling me he was president of the Royal College of Surgeons or the Archbishop of Canterbury. "I never heard that word before," I said. "Did you invent it?" "Of course I didn't invent it," he replied. "It's the name given to them who's risen to the very top of their profession. You've heard of goldsmiths and silversmiths, for instance. They're experts in gold and silver. I'm an expert with my fingers, so I'm a fingersmith. It must be an interesting job." "It's a marvelous job," he answered. "It's lovely. Is that why you're going to the races?" "Race meetings are easy meat," he said. "You just stand around after the race, watching for the lucky ones to queue up and draw their money. And when you see someone collecting a big bundle of notes, you simply follow after them and help yourself. But don't get me wrong, Governor. I never take nothing from a loser, nor from poor people, neither. I only go after them that can afford it, the winners and the rich." "That's very thoughtful of you," I said. "How often do you get caught?" "Caught?" he cried disgustedly. "Me get caught? It's only pickpockets that get caught. Fingersmiths, never." "Listen, I could take the false teeth out of your mouth if I wanted to, and you wouldn't even catch me." "I don't have any false teeth," I said. "I know you don't," he answered. "Otherwise, I'd have had them out a long time ago." I believed him. Those long, slim fingers seemed to be able to do anything. We drove on for a while without talking. "That policeman's going to check up on you pretty thoroughly," I said. "Doesn't that worry you a bit?" "Nobody's checking up on me," he said. "Of course they are. He's got your name and address written down, most carefully in his little black book. The man gave me another of his sly little ratty smiles. Ah, he said, so he has. But I'll be betting he ain't got them all written down in his memory as well. I've never known a copper yet with a decent memory. Some of them can't even remember their own name. What's memory got to do with it, I asked. It's written down in his book, isn't it? Yes, Governor, it is. Trouble is, he's lost his book. He's lost both his books, the one with my name in it and the one with yours. In the long, delicate fingers of his right hand, the man was holding, in triumph, the two books that he had taken from the policeman's pockets. Easiest job I ever done, he announced proudly. I nearly swerved the car into a milk truck, I was so excited. That copper's got nothing on either of us now, he said. You're a genius, he cried. He's got no names, no addresses, no car number, no nothing, he said. You're brilliant. I think you'd better pull off the main road as soon as possible, he said. Then we'd better build a little bonfire and burn these books. You're a fantastic fellow, I exclaimed. Thank you, Governor, he said. It's always nice to be appreciated.